Hello and to Who Are Your Talks. In this episode we speak to an international football manager. Justin Whalley was the manager of the Matabililand football team in the 2018 CONIFA World Cup. His is a football journey that's taken him from Leicestershire to Zimbabwe via setting up a team in Latvia and travelling the world in the name of football. His book, One Football No Nets, is the story of Matabililand's journey to the alternative World Cup in London. It's out now. And we chat about the book, CONIFA, meeting Bruce Grobler in a car park, and what it was that inspired Justin to travel the globe in search of football. In case we don't see you before then, from myself and Ben, have a great Christmas and a happy new year too. The first question then is, the name of the podcast is Who Are You? So who are you and what do you do?
So my name's Justin Whalley. I was the head coach of the Matabililand football team, and I finished that role in the summer, shortly after the World Football Cup, the CONIFA World Football Cup, which was held in London. And since then, really, I've spent most of that time writing a book, which has just been published, called One Football No Nets. I'm now home for Christmas in Leicestershire and happy to be doing very little apart from eating and drinking too much.
Well, we'll get to the CONIFA World Cup and the book in due course, but we'll start with kind of, we like to ask every guest like about their broader relationship with football. So do you remember what it was that got you interested in football in the first place? And it's usually when the kid, so when you're a kid, what was your relationship with football like?
Yeah, so I really just my first memories are, yeah, starting to kick a ball around at school, 6 years old. Memories of playing around in the muddy field at St Albert's, where I went to school, and starting to play for that team. And around the same time, my grandfather started taking me, my mum's father started taking me to Northampton Town. So I was going down there, seeing the big floodlights at the county ground, and you know, the buzz of a little boy going to watch the football there. So that's where it started, really, falling in love with the game. And not long after that, I think you had the 78 World Cup, and I had a bit of a love of Holland. Cried when they lost, which I wouldn't said I wouldn't do today for sure. The Brian Clough Forest team around that time as well. Just bits you saw on the telly, I just loved that team, and had the Panini out, you know, sticker albums. And I think, like a lot of young boys at that time who were into the football, it was just every opportunity to kick a ball. If it was lunchtime at school, after school in the backyard, in the garden, up the park, just obsessed with playing, really. And yeah, watching when you could, but it was really about the playing and just a love of the game. I was speaking to my mum the other day, and I was saying, a lot of people say that school, well, some people say school was the best time of their life, and for me it certainly wasn't, but the one very positive memory about school was just playing football, really. Be it with your mates or be it in school teams. So yeah, just carried on playing all through my teenage years. And then played in a good, very good school team at John Cleveland and Hinckley. We won a county cup. And then started playing men's Sunday League 16. Before I went to uni at Bournemouth, and very honoured to be asked to be the player manager, player captain, as they call it at the time, of the Bournemouth University second team. So that was where my first role first responsibility came in football, if you like. And then yeah, I left Bournemouth. I did business and marketing, and I had a big dream to work in football marketing, and That was the sort of the road I wanted to go down. I also did a coaching badge not long after I left Bournemouth. And Went out to the USA, did a project with the Football Supporters Association group over there, looking at the World Cup ahead of Euro 96. Worked at Euro 96. I was working in Nottingham as the assistant director for the city of Nottingham. So it was all geared towards a life in football, isn't it? But it didn't quite go anywhere after that. And then I just decided to go backpacking and see the world and chase pretty girls and all those things. So that's where I thought the story was going to end. To be honest with you, at the start.
And so tell us a bit about Riga United. I gather it was. That was your next job in football, if you like.
Yeah, I went to I discovered Riga traveling and decided to move out there and see if I could live out in Latvia. It was very exciting times out there, around 2000. Went and went out and just started missing playing football. Just wanted to kick about really and. A lad that I was at the I ended up teaching English there, and the lad I taught with, John, we eventually just started to organise a kickabout, five-a-side. Just a couple of expats and some local lads, and nothing special. Just hiring out a court and being able to play and maybe have a beer afterwards, and that kind of. You know, a few years later, I would say it was one of the things that led into Riga United. You know, it was a sort of an organised football and an interest in a group of people, and that eventually led to Riga United being founded in 2007. It kind of started to exist without that name, sort of from 2005, probably. So I was just a bit involved in the co-founding of that. A gentleman called Austin Nicholas, he founded the club, and was involved in sort of thinking about the name and the crest and the colours and all those things. And we went down to the Football Federation and told them, we wanted to create a football club that would eventually end up playing in the league, in the national leagues. And that's what happened. I guess another six years later, the club ended up entering the Latvian National League, which would be the third tier. And then it was just, a much more serious thing with, men's first and second teams. We established an academy for kids and eventually also a ladies team, which plays in the Latvian Premier League today.
I'm reading on your website that Riga United is Europe's most cosmopolitan National League amateur football club. Is that due to everyone involved in the founding of it coming from abroad?
It's a funny one because Riga's, although it's like anywhere, it's going that way. But, you know, years ago, you'd hardly ever see a foreigner in Riga. And I think what happened is we drew in most of the foreigners who lived in Riga and wanted to play football, really. And it became just sort of a community thing. And it wasn't just a foreigners thing. It was a mixture of local lads and foreigners. And there's that Russian Latvian thing that goes on in Latvia as well. And I think in those days, it was a much bigger issue, that divide in the community there. So we kind of had three communities, really. We had the foreigners, we had the Latvian Latvians and the Russian Latvians all together in one team. So that's why it started to become the kind of a cosmopolitan club of sorts. And then we used to play, the club used to play a lot of touring teams, used to come over. So we had that sort of quirkiness to us. We we attracted a lot of attention. There was no other club like us. I mean, there was no other club where foreigners played, unless, you know, the odd professionals came in from abroad. And then once Latvia joined the European Union, it was, the floodgates really opened up in Latvia, and more people started moving to Riga. So it ended up that, you know, you could start to attract some very, very good footballers, be it ex-pros or lads who would have made it if they hadn't chosen certain careers. So the quality just started going up, and being the only club of its nature, I think we had pretty much attracted every foreigner, every amateur footballer there was that came to Latvia. And then with the establishment of the establishment of the academy, what that did is we then had lots of international families that moved to Latvia, heads of offices of multinational companies, and they're in the international schools. So suddenly you had, kids from anywhere from Kazakhstan to Iceland as well at the club. And then the next stage, I think, with the women's team, we really brought in a lot of girls from abroad, which is something that never happened in Latvian football before. And they were students from especially from places like Norway and Germany. It was incredible. At one point, we just started adding it up, and we had I think at one point we had 40 different nationalities at the club at one time, And then we started writing them all down, and we came to 50 or 60. I don't remember what the figure was, but there were 50 or 60 different nationalities had played for us. So it's funny, it was an incredibly cosmopolitan club in a place that's not very cosmopolitan, and certainly not until recently.
Yeah, and yeah. It's an amazing story. And I wonder if being involved in the foundation of a new football club, and being involved with setting up the academy, setting up the women's team, all these things, has that maybe changed your relationship with the game in any way? Has it given you a greater appreciation or a greater understanding of the game, do you think?
One of the ways of thinking of the football club is that we were always open. So we had open trainings. And that's very, very difficult to manage because you get some right ringers coming down sometimes. But we tried to do that. It was open doors. Anyone could come down. And then if it's properly managed, then, you quickly spot the lads or the girls aren't quite good enough, and you get them training on the side or whatever. But it's just a very good way of saying anyone can come down and be part of this and of unifying something. And I think football should be for everyone. It really should be. I mean, fundamentally, it's about enjoying yourself. People dream of being fantastic footballers, but the reality is that most people are average at best. So I think that's something that the clubs has done better than most clubs have managed to do over the years. And I think that opens my mind to the possibilities there are with a club and what you can do, because we also had very little money, but we used marketing as a way of social media, as a way of spreading the message and a good message about what we were doing. And we gained a lot of attention through not really spending much money, but through a lot of hard work, of course. And you can just see a thing. You can just see a thing grow because you believe in it, and it's a thing of beauty. And I think that's what I think Riga United is a very, very special kind of club. It's hard to imagine that the men will ever play at much of a high level because of rules with foreigners' rule and things like that. But it doesn't necessarily matter. It's a community club. And we've got the women who can play at the highest level. It's forged links with people all over the world. And I think I think it's something that is a case study a lot of people could look at and learn something from, actually, in football.
Tell us about the events of One Football No Nets then. How is it that you end up becoming a national team manager for an unofficial international side?
I'd been doing the hard work with Riga United, and I'd really got to a point where I'd taken on too much personally. There was a lot of us with roles at the club, but I had a lot of different roles, from club secretary to head coach of the ladies team at the time to marketing manager and what have you, and I just felt exhausted with it, and I needed a bit of a break, and I went travelling with my girlfriend at the time, Katya, and just looking at what I was going to do next, and I was going to leave football really, but it didn't work out what I planned to do, and then I went sort of soul searching to decide what to do, and I just reflected on it and said, no, I mean, I want to go back into football and find a new adventure, really. And I just come up with this crazy idea to try and manage international football. And as crazy as that sounds, I sort of understood that that's possible to do by going somewhere, you know, very remote, unknown and under-resourced. So I just started looking into that as a possibility, and almost went to the South Pacific. I got offered a role out there, but that fell through. And then through contacts I had at Conifa, who I'd just along that journey, I'd got just found out actually about Conifa while I was at Riga United, just from a German guy who came over. Just became aware of the Matabililand role and put my name in the hat at the time. And I think I'm someone that's done a lot of travel, and I'm willing to put myself into situations. And I think at the time that was just, I was just a person that was able to take that role on.
For the uninitiated then, tell us about Matabililand. First of all, is that the way to pronounce it? And second of all, where is it? Where is it? What kind of place is it? And why is the football team a Conifa football team?
Yeah, it's in Western Zimbabwe. It represents the Ndebele people, or the Matabele people. So principally Zimbabwe is either Shona or Ndebele. It's not the only definitions there, but the Ndebele is you know, it's a different tribal group, has a different separate history. So within the rules of Conifa, that you could have a representative football for an organizer for a group like that. The Matabililand team was formed. It was formed, I guess, 15 months or so, 18 months before I joined them. But it was formed not necessarily thinking they were ever going to end up at a World Football Cup, but really just to help people in the community and to help put them on their feet and give them belief in themselves and organise football, all the things that we know can come from that, you know, through a community project. You know, hopefully one or two boys get spotted and go on to greater things. And it just was used really as a vehicle to help develop that community. And based in Bulawayo, that's the second city of Zimbabwe, the first city of the Ndebele. And they joined Conifa. They managed to qualify for London through playing regional games.
And I came in really, they'd already qualified for London when I came in. So I just came in really to help manage it on and off the pitch, along with the two gentlemen that run the FA, both of whom are called Bisani. And so it was like a three of us really working towards trying to take the team to London, to the World Cup.
And what challenges were involved in that then, just kind of on and off the pitch?
Well, it was a very sensitive time to travel out to Zimbabwe because it was the final days of the Mugabe regime. And when I arrived, you appreciated that things were deteriorating quite quickly in the country, economically, politically. So it was challenging to be there at that time, because you just no one knew where the country was headed, and it did head eventually towards some people would call a military coup, a bloodless military coup. Some people call transition, but whatever you want to call it, the army came in and removed Mugabe from office. And for myself, it was a bit of a dangerous time potentially because I as an outsider there, it looked suspicious what I was doing there. Were we trying to create an independence movement? We weren't, but certain people, I think, believed that we were trying to push something down in that direction, but it was never about that. So yeah, that was the starting point. The economy is a bit of a basket case, to be honest. It's still not been sorted out, sadly. I mean, when you're there, you can't withdraw money from ATMs. Most people are surviving with digital money, local digital money that's created. There's a thing called the bond dollar, which is equivalent to US, but then there's a black market economy. And there's a shortage of dollars, and there's a shortage of products in the shops, and all these things are going on. So that made things difficult. And then the FA itself, the Matabeleland Football Confederacy, we just had no funding really. So everything that was being done was being done on a shoestring, and I mean in every sense. I mean, a few dollars a week to run the whole show, so all of us were voluntary. We at the start just didn't really have footballs and bibs and cones and this stuff with it. And we reached a point, I think, where we just had the one ball and we didn't own our own nets, and we had, I think, about six bibs. But you muddle through, and there's a lot of very, very talented footballers and a lot of people working very, very hard and dreaming of making it. So I just try to add my sense of where we needed to travel to try and get us to London on and off the pitch, which also involved raising a lot of money. We needed probably $30,000 to get the team to London. So you'll appreciate that involves quite a lot of work when you don't have sponsors.
Yeah. So tell us about the World Football Cup then in London. First of all, if you could give us some background to the event and what it was like for you as a manager of a team there.
Well, I mean, when I took the role on, it wasn't just we talked about the incredible opportunity to coach was essentially an international team, but not only that, to take them potentially to a World Cup of sorts. I mean, talk about a dream come true. You can't believe that you can have an opportunity like that. But you know what's involved in getting there, as we said, we had to work miracles really between us all. But we did it, and it was, I mean, you'll see it in the book, but I mean, we had the visas unofficially turned down just a few days before we left. I mean, literally at the final hours, really. So we had no team. And then we lost the flights around the same time as well, because we've been holding flights for a long time. And it just looked like the whole thing was a complete and utter disaster. But we had to, Mr. Grobbelaar involved, and had the president of Zimbabwe, the new president of Zimbabwe involved, and lots of other things going on. And we made it. We got on the plane and we got to London. And for me personally, I can't speak for other people, but for me personally, it was you know, the priority was getting us to London. I mean, I want to, obviously you want to do as well as you can, but it was getting us there. And yeah, we got there, and then we were the happiest team there, didn't it, regardless of whether we won a game or we won all the games or we lost all the games, it wasn't so much about that. It was about us going there and celebrating the fact we were there and having a good time. And I think we did that. We showed, I think a lot of people fell in love with the team, with the spirit of the team. And as the tournament went on, I think we also started to show we could play a bit of football. We did really well as the World Cup went on. I mean, with the first two games we played, two teams who ended up in the semi-finals, so that was tough. We lost against them. But then we won a couple of games and drew. I think we won three games and drew one after that. So very, very respectable. And most of all, just I think we earned respect, you know, on and off the pitch in London. So it was just fantastic, fantastic experience, really.
Yeah. So you briefly mentioned on the back of your book, Bruce Grobbelaar ends up becoming your goalkeeping coach. How does that happen?
Well, I did my first stint in Zimbabwe, and I went back to Europe, and I went back to Europe, and I knew I had to raise a lot of money and a lot of awareness, and I started from, if we talk about the non-football, because the football continued in Zimbabwe, and the guys worked very hard, and that went on every day without me involved, but a lot of trying to kickstart the fundraising, that was a big responsibility, came on me at that time. And we just looked at it, and we just thought, really, let's try and bring Grobbelaar in. You know, you don't know unless you ask. You know, ask in life, and sometimes you get things. And I sent him an email in January, and I sent emails to hundreds of people. I sent emails to BBC, CNN. I sent them to football clubs. I sent them to coaches. And you know, a lot of people never reply. But I sent to Bruce, and he replied, I think it was the following morning or the morning after that. And then we just agreed to meet the next time. I was in Latvia at the time. And I agreed to meet with him when I was in England, before I went back out to Zimbabwe. Met him, as it said, at M6 service station. We ended up meeting. It was all very surreal. Bruce said he was very happy to come on board and to join us. So, you know, he didn't guarantee that we would get to London, but I knew it was a massive, massive boost for where we for our chances of getting to the World Cup, you know.
Just a bit of context for anyone listening to us who might not already know about the CONIFA World Cup. It's a tournament for minorities and stateless people, so not official FIFA or UEFA nations. So there's names like Tibet and Tuvalu that people may have heard of, but also a lot of teams representing whoever they may be. They may be displaced peoples within other countries. So there was 16 teams in this tournament in London. Do you think the stock and the profile of CONIFA is only going to grow? And how has it grown over the few years?
I think when we talked about that tournament, we knew that going to London with a successful tournament should really push CONIFA on to bigger things. It was a massive gamble because you'd appreciate it's just such an expensive place to hold a tournament. And when you have a limited number of sponsors and money behind you, it's very, very difficult. We were lucky that that Paddy Power came in and got involved as the title sponsor of the tournament. It's run by volunteers. And you know the guys like Paul Watson that drove that tournament. It's just what they achieve is incredible. And I hesitate there because there's a whole list of names, and I don't want to go through because I'll miss people out. But the people who drove this on a voluntary basis and succeeded in hosting a very, very good tournament. I think we had a lot of good press following us from all over the world. And I think it was just a different message in what we were doing. I think a lot of people were very impressed by. And I think you're going to have lots more members joining in the future and much more profile. But it's tough. It's just hosting a successful tournament. You've got to kick on from that, you know, and becoming bigger. As I know, what happened with us for Riga United, when you're volunteering, it's very tough. So it's an awful lot to do with the people who run it, to be honest, and having the right kind of people. And they're quite the opposite from some of the people that you might have in FIFA, for example, who get paid a lot of money but might not have the love of the game. You know, fortunately, CONIFA has people that are there for the right reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a couple of quick questions then before I let you go. I'd noticed on your website it mentioned you've attended 6 World Cups, 6 European Championships, 2 Copa Americas. You've lived in 9 countries and visited 125 states and territories. It's going to be hard to pick a favourite, but do you have a favourite stadium and B, a favourite experience watching football? We'll go for watching football as a fan.
Oh, gosh. It's one of those. I wish I had time to think about this.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, you know, look, I spent this summer afterwards. I went straight to Russia and went to the World Cup there. And as a tournament, that was just a real pleasure to be involved in that whole Russia World Cup. So as a tournament, that was absolutely fantastic. I think out of all the World Cups and Euros, that was the most fun and enjoyable thing, which I think people didn't expect. I love the Copa Americas. I've been to the Chile and Argentina one, and I love the fact that feels a bit more raw and a bit more real. And I very much hope to go to the Brazil Copa America.
If you want to maybe tell us a bit about the book and where you can get it.
Yeah, so the book's the publisher's Benny and Kearney, but you can find it. It's on Amazon. So One Football No Nets. Just search that on Amazon, and that's sent. That's now available worldwide. In the first week or two, there was some distribution issues, but that's all been resolved now. So it's readily available. It's on Kindle. And it's available in print as well. 350 pages. There's a lot of photos in there. It's about 50. I think there's about 50 photos in the book as well. So it really tells the story from searching to get a job in international football all the way to the end of the CONIFA World Cup, and then the epilogue is my time in Russia and all the crazy things that went on there that when I thought things were quieting down. It's readily available now. So just jump onto Amazon and you'll find it.
Okay, fantastic. You don't have to think of your ultimate favourite experience for anything pop into your head in the last minute or so.
Ultimate experience. Well, the ultimate experience in football was certainly leading Atabililand in London. I mean, that was beyond anything I've been involved in over the years.
Justin, thank you very much.